Waff was like that animal right now. She could see his hands longing for a weapon. But the Lazu and Bene Gesserit had searched one another with exquisite care before coming here. She felt sure he had no weapon. Still. Waff spoke, bated suspense in his manner.
You think me unaware of how you hope to rule us.
And there is the rot that the people of the scattering took with them, she said. Rot at the core. Waff's manner changed. It did not do to ignore the deeper implications of Bene Gesserit thought. But was she sowing discord? The prophet set a locator ticking in the minds of every human, scattered or not, Terraza said. He has brought them back to us with all of the rot intact. Waff ground his teeth. What was she doing? He entertained the mad thought that the sisterhood had clogged his mind with some secret drug in the air. They knew things denied to others. He stared from Terraza to Odraid and back to Terraza. He knew he was old with serial Gola resurrections, but not old in the way of the Bene Gesserit. These people were old. They seldom looked old, but they were old. Old beyond anything he dared imagine. Terraza was having similar thoughts. She had seen the flash of deeper awareness in Waff's eyes. Necessity opened new doors of reason. How deep did the Tlilazu go? His eyes were so old. She had the feeling that whatever had been a brain in these Tlilazu masters was now something else, a holo-recording from which all weakening emotions had been erased. She shared the distrust of emotions that she suspected in him. Was that a bond to unite them? The tropism of common thoughts.
You say you release your grip on us, Waff growled. But I feel your fingers around my throat.
Then here is a grip on your throat, she said. Some of your lost ones have returned to you. Never has a reverend mother come back to us from the scattering.
But you said you knew all of the...
We have other ways of gaining knowledge. What do you suppose happened to the reverend mothers we sent out into the scattering?
A common disaster?
He shook his head. This was absolutely new information. None of the returned Lilazu had said anything at all about this. The discrepancy fed his suspicions. Whom was he to believe?
They were subverted, Terraza said.
Odraid, hearing the general suspicion voiced for the first time by the Mother Superior, sensed the enormous power implicit in Terraza's simple statement. Odraid was cowed by it. She knew the resources, the contingency plans, the improvised ways a Reverend Mother might use to surmount barriers. Something out there could stop that. When Waff did not respond, Terraza said, "You come to us with dirty hands."
You dare say this? Waff asked. You who continue to deplete our resources in the ways taught you by the Bashar's mother?
We knew you could afford the losses if you had resources from the scattering, Terraza said. Waff inhaled a trembling breath. So the Bene Gesserit knew even this. He saw in part how they had learned it. Well, a way would have to be found to bring the false Tuek back under control. Rakis was the prize the scattered ones really sought, and it might yet be demanded of the Tlilazu. Terraza moved even closer to Waff, alone and vulnerable. She saw her guards grow tense. Shiana took a small step toward the Mother Superior and was pulled back by Odraid. Odraid kept her attention on the Mother Superior and not on potential attackers. Were the Tlilazu truly convinced that the Bene Gesserit would serve them? Terraza had tested the limits of it, no doubt of that. And in the language of the Islamiyat. But she looked very alone out there, away from her guards, and so near Waff and his people. Where would Waff's obvious suspicions lead him now? Terraza shivered. Odraid saw it. Terraza had been abnormally thin as a child, and had never put on an excess ounce of fat. This made her exquisitely sensitive to temperature changes, intolerant of cold. But Odrade sensed no such change in the room. Terraza had made a dangerous decision then, so dangerous that her body betrayed her. Not dangerous to her, of course, but dangerous to the sisterhood. There was the most awful Bene Gesserit crime, disloyalty to their own order. "We will serve you in all ways except one," Terraza said. "We will never become receptacles for Golas." Wath paled. Terraza continued. "None of us is now, nor will ever become," she paused, "an axolotl tank." Waff raised his right hand in the start of a gesture every Reverend Mother knew, the signal for his face dancers to attack. Terraza pointed at his upraised hand. "If you complete that gesture, the Tlilazu will lose everything." "The messenger of God," Terraza nodded over a shoulder toward Shiana, "will turn her back upon you, and the words of the prophet will be dust in your mouths." In the language of Islamiyat, such words were too much for Wath. He lowered his hand, but he continued to glower at Terraza. "My ambassador said we should share everything we know," Terraza said. "You said you too would share. The messenger of God listens with the ears of the prophet. What pours forth from the Abdul of the Tlilazu?" Waf's shoulders sagged. Terraza turned her back on him. It was an artful move, but both she and the other Reverend Mothers present knew she did it now in perfect safety. Looking across the room at Odrade, Terraza allowed herself a smile that she knew Odrade would interpret correctly. Time for a bit of Bene Gesserit punishment. "The Tlilazu desire an Atreides for breeding," Terraza said. "I give you Darwi Odrade. More will be supplied." Waff came to a decision. "You may know much about the honored maters," he said, "but you..." "Whores," Terraza whirled on him. "As you will. But there is a thing from them that your words reveal you do not know. I seal our bargain by telling you this. They can magnify the sensations of the orgasmic platform transmitting this throughout a male body. They elicit the total sensual involvement of the male. Multiple orgasmic waves are created and may be continued by the female for an extended period." "Total involvement?" Terraza did not try to hide her astonishment. Odrade, too, listened with a sense of shock that she saw was shared by her sisters present, even the acolytes. Only Shiana seemed not to understand. "I tell you, Mother Superior Terraza," Waff said, a gloating smile on his face, "that we have duplicated this with our own people, myself even. In my anger, I caused the face dancer who played the female part to destroy itself. No one... I say no one may have such a hold on me." "What hold?" "If it had been one of these whores, as you call them, I would have obeyed her without question in anything." He shuddered. "I barely had the will to destroy." He shook his head in bewilderment at the memory. "Anger saved me." Terraza tried to swallow in a dry throat. "How? How is it done?" "Very well. But before I share this knowledge, I warn you. If one of you ever tries to use this power over one of us, bloody slaughter will follow. We have prepared our domel and all of our people to respond by killing all Reverend Mothers they can find at the slightest sign that you seek this power over us." "None of us would do that, but not because of your threat. We are restrained by the knowledge that this would destroy us. Your bloody slaughter would not be necessary." "Oh? Then why does it not destroy these whores?" "It does. and it destroys everyone they touch.
It has not destroyed me.
God protects you, my Abdul, Taraza said, as he protects all of the faithful. Convinced, Waf glanced around the room and back to Taraza.
Let all know that I fulfill my bond in the land of the Prophet. This is the way of it, then.
He waved a hand to two of his face dancer guards.
We will demonstrate.
Much later, alone in the penthouse room, Odraid wondered if it had been wise to let Shiana see the whole performance. Well, why not? Shiana already was committed to the sisterhood, and it would have aroused Waf's suspicions to send Shiana away. There had been obvious sensual arousal in Shiana as she watched the face dancer performance. The training proctors would have to call in their male assistants earlier than usual for Shiana. What would Shiana do then? Would she try this new knowledge on the men? Inhibitions must be raised in Shiana to prevent that. She must be taught the dangers to herself. The sisters and acolytes present had controlled themselves well, storing what they learned firmly in memory. Shiana's education must be built on that observation. Others mastered such internal forces. The face dancer observers had remained inscrutable, but there had been things to see in Waf. He said he would destroy the two demonstrators, but what would he do first? Would he succumb to temptation? What thoughts went through his mind as he watched the face dancer male squirm in mind-blanking ecstasy? In a way, the demonstration reminded Odraid of the Rakian dance she had seen in the Great Square of Keen. In the short term, the dance had been deliberately unrhythmic, but the progression created a long-term rhythm that repeated itself in some 200 steps. The dancers had stretched out their rhythm to a remarkable degree, as had the face dancer demonstrators. Sayenak became a sexual grip on uncounted billions in the scattering. Odraid thought about the dance, the long rhythm followed by chaotic violence. Sayenak's glorious focusing of religious energies had developed into a different kind of exchange. She thought about Shiana's excited response to her glimpse of that dance in the Great Square. Odraid remembered asking Shiana, "What did they share down there?" "The dancers, silly." That response had not been permissible. "I've warned you about that tone, Shiana. Do you wish to learn immediately what a reverend mother can do to punish you?" The words played themselves like ghost messages in Odraid's mind as she looked at the gathering darkness outside the Daras Balat penthouse. A great loneliness welled up in her. All the others had gone from this room. Only the punished one remained. How bright-eyed Shiana had been in that room above the Great Square, her mind so full of questions. "Why do you always talk about hurting and punishment? You must learn discipline. How can you control others when you cannot control yourself? I don't like that lesson. None of us does very much, until later when we've learned the value of it by experience." As intended, that response had festered long in Shiana's awareness. In the end, she had revealed all she knew about the dance. "Some of the dancers escape. Others go directly to Shaitan. The priests say they go to Shai-Halud. What of the ones who survive? When they recover, they must join a great dance in the desert. If Shaitan comes there, they die. If Shaitan does not come, they are rewarded." Odraid had seen the pattern. Shiana's explanatory words had not been necessary beyond that point, even though the recital had been allowed to continue. How bitter Shiana's voice had been. "They get money, space in a bazaar, that kind of reward. The priests say they have proved they are human. Are the ones who fail not human?" Shiana had remained silent for a long time in deep thought. The track was clear to Odraid, though. The sisterhood's test of humanity. Her own passage into the acceptable humanity of the sisterhood had already been duplicated by Shiana. How soft that passage seemed in comparison to the other panes. In the dim light of the museum penthouse, Odrade held up her right hand, looking at it, remembering the agony box. And the Gamjabar poised at her neck, ready to kill her if she flinched or cried out. Shiana had not cried out either, but she had known the answer to Odrade's question even before the agony box. They are human but different. Odrade spoke aloud in the empty room, with its displays from the tyrant's no-chamber hoard. What did you do to us, Leto? Are you only Shaitan talking to us? What would you force us to share now? Was the fossil dance to become fossil sex? Who are you talking to, Mother? It was Shiana's voice from the open doorway across the room. Her gray postulant's robe was only a faint shape there, growing larger as she approached. Mother Superior sent me for you, Shiana said as she came to a stop near Odrade. I was talking to myself, Odrade said. She looked at the strangely quiet girl, remembering the gut-wrenching excitement of that moment when the fulcrum question had been asked of Shiana. Do you wish to be a reverend mother? Why are you talking to yourself, Mother? There was a load of concern in Shiana's voice. The teaching proctors would have their hands full removing those emotions. I was remembering when I asked you if you wished to be a reverend mother, Odrade said. It prompted other thoughts. You said I must give myself to your direction in all things, holding back nothing, disobeying you in nothing. And you said, is that all? I didn't know very much, did I? I still don't know very much. None of us does, child. Except that we're all in the dance together. And Shaitan will certainly come if the least of us fails. When strangers meet, great allowance should be made for differences of custom and training. The Lady Jessica, from Wisdom of Arrakis. The last greenish line of light fell out of the horizon before Burzmali gave the signal for them to move. It was dark by the time they reached the far side of Isai and the perimeter road that was to lead them to Duncan. Clouds covered the sky, reflecting the city's lights downward onto the shapes of the urban hovels through which their guides directed them. These guides bothered Lucilla. They appeared out of side streets and from suddenly open doorways to whisper new directions. Too many people knew about the fugitive pair and their intended rendezvous. She had come to grips with her hatred, but the residue was a profound distrust of every person they saw. Hiding this behind the mechanical attitudes of a play femme with her customer had become increasingly difficult. There was slush on the pedestrian way beside the road, most of it scattered there by the passage of ground cars. Lucilla's feet were cold before they had gone half a kilometer, and she was forced to expend energy compensating for the added blood flow in her extremities. Burzmali walked silently, his head down, apparently lost in his own worries. Lucilla was not fooled. He heard every sound around them, saw every approaching vehicle. He hustled them off the pathway each time a ground car approached. The cars went swishing past on their suspensers, the dirty slush flying from under their fan skirts and peppering the bushes along the road. Burzmali held her down beside him in the snow until he was sure the cars were out of sight and sound. Not that anyone riding in them could hear much, except their own whirling passage. They had been walking for 2 hours before Burzmali stopped and took stock of the way ahead. Their destination was a perimeter community that had been described to them as completely safe. Lucilla knew better. No place on Gamu was completely safe. Yellow lights cast an undershot glow on the clouds ahead of them, marking the location of the community. Their slushy progress took them through a tunnel under the perimeter road and up a low hill planted to some sort of orchard. The limbs were stark in the dim light. Lucilla glanced upward. The clouds were thinning. Gamu had many small moons, fortress no-ships. Some of them had been placed by Teg, but she glimpsed lines of new ones sharing the guardian role. They appeared to be about four times the size of the brightest stars, and they often traveled together, which made their reflected light useful but erratic, because they moved fast, up across the sky and below the horizon in only a few hours. She glimpsed a string of six such moons through a break in the clouds, wondering if they were part of Teg's defense system. Momentarily, she reflected on the inherent weakness of the siege mentality that such defenses represented. Teg had been right about them. Mobility was the key to military success, but she doubted that he had meant mobility on foot. There were no easy hiding places on the snow-whitened slope, and Lucilla felt Bersmali's nervousness. What could they do here if someone came? A snow-covered depression led down from their position to the left, angling toward the community. It was not a road, but she thought it might be a path. "Down this way," Bersmali said, leading them into the depression. The snow came up to their calves. "I hope these people are trustworthy," she said. "They hate the honored maters," he said. "That's enough for me." "The Gola had better be there." She held back an even more angry response, but could not keep herself from adding, "Their hatred isn't enough for me." It was better to expect the worst, she thought. She had come to a reassuring thought about Bersmali, though. He was like Teg. Neither of them pursued a course that would lead them into a dead end, not if they could help it. She suspected there were support forces concealed in the bushes around them even now. The snow-covered trail ended in a paved pathway, gently curved inward from the edges and kept free of snow by a melt system. There was a trickle of dampness in the center. Lucilla was several steps onto this path before she recognized what it must be, a mag chute. It was an ancient magnetic transport base that once had carried goods or raw materials to a pre-scattering factory. "It gets steeper here," Bersmali warned her. "They've carved steps in it, but watch it. They're not very deep." They came presently to the end of the mag chute. It stopped at a decrepit wall, local brick atop a plasteel foundation. The faint light of stars in a clearing sky revealed crude workmanship in the bricks, typical famine times construction. The wall was a mass of vines and mottled fungus. The growth did little to conceal the cracked courses of the bricks and the crude efforts to fill chinks with mortar. A single row of narrow windows looked down onto the place where the mag chute debouched into a mass of bushes and weeds. Three of the windows glowed electric blue with some inner activity that was accompanied by faint crackling sounds. "This was a factory in the old days," Bersmali said. "I have eyes and a memory," Lucilla snapped. Did this grunting male think her completely devoid of intelligence? Something creaked dismally off to their left. A patch of sod and weeds lifted atop a cellar door, accompanied by an upward glow of brilliant yellow light. "Quick!" Bersmali led her at a swift run across thick vegetation and down a flight of steps exposed by the lifting door. The door creaked closed behind them in a grumbling of machinery. Lucilla found herself in a large space with a low ceiling. Light came from long lines of modern glow globes strung along massive plasteel girders overhead. The floor was swept clean but showed scratches and indentations of activity, the locations no doubt of bygone machinery. She glimpsed movement far off across the open space. A young woman in a version of Lucilla's dragon robe trotted toward them. Lucilla sniffed. There was a stink of acid in the room and undertones of something foul. "This was a Harkonnen factory," Bersmali said. "I wonder what they made here." The young woman stopped in front of Lucilla. She had a willowy figure, elegant in shape and motion under the clinging robe. A subcutaneous glow came from her face. It spoke of exercise and good health. The green eyes, though, were hard and chilling in the way they measured everything they saw. "So they sent more than one of us to watch this place," she said. Lucilla put out a restraining hand as Brismali started to respond. This woman was not what she seemed. "No more than I am." Lucilla chose her words carefully. "We always know each other, it seems." The young woman smiled. "I watched your approach. I could not believe my eyes." She swept a sneering glance across Brismali. "This was supposed to be a customer?" "And guide," Lucilla said. She noted the puzzlement on Brismali's face and prayed he would not ask the wrong question. This young woman was danger. "Weren't we expected?" Brismali asked.
"Ah, it speaks," the young woman said, laughing.
Her laugh was as cold as her eyes. "I prefer that you do not refer to me as it," Brismali said.
"I call Gamu scum anything I wish," the young woman said.
"Don't speak to me of your preferences."
"What did you call me?"
Brismali was tired, and his anger came boiling up at this unexpected attack.
"I call you anything I choose, scum."
Brismali had suffered enough. Before Lucilla could stop him, he uttered a low growl and aimed a heavy slap at the young woman. The blow did not land. Lucilla watched in fascination as the woman dropped under the attack, caught Brismali's sleeve as one might catch a bit of fabric blowing in the wind, and in a blindingly fast pirouette, whose speed almost hid its delicacy, sent Brismali skidding across the floor. The woman dropped to a half-crouch on one foot. The other prepared to kick.
"I shall kill him now," she said.
Lucilla, not knowing what might happen next, folded her body sideways, barely avoiding the woman's suddenly out-thrust foot, and countered with a standard Bene Gesserit sabard that dumped the young woman on her back, doubled up where the blow had caught her in the abdomen. "A suggestion that you kill my guide is uncalled for, whatever your name is," Lucilla said. The young woman gasped for breath, then panting between words, "I am called Mirbella, great honored mater. You shame me by defeating me with such a slow attack. Why do you do that?"
"You needed a lesson," Lucilla said.
"I am only newly robed, great honored mater. Please forgive me."
"I thank you for the splendid lesson, and will thank you every time I employ your response, which I now commit to memory."
She bowed her head, then leaped lightly to her feet, an impish grin on her face. In her coldest voice, Lucilla asked, "Do you know who I am?" Out of the corners of her eyes, she saw Brismali regain his feet with painful slowness. He remained at one side, watching the women, but anger burned his face.
"From your ability to teach me that lesson, I see that you are who you are, great honored mater. Am I forgiven?"
The impish grin had vanished from Mirbella's face. She stood with head bowed.
"You are forgiven. Is there no ship coming?"
"So they say here. We are prepared for it." Mirbella glanced at Brismali.
"He is still useful to me, and it is required that he accompany me," Lucilla said.
"Very good, great honored mater. Does your forgiveness include your name?"
"No,"
Mirbella sighed. "We have captured the Gola," she said. "He came as a Tlilazu from the south. I was just about to bed him when you arrived." Brismali hobbled toward them. Lucilla saw that he had recognized the danger. This completely safe place had been infested by enemies, but the enemies still knew very little.
"The Gola was not injured?" Brismali asked.
It still speaks, Mirbella said. How odd. You will not bed the Gola, Lucilla said. That one is my special charge. Fair game, great honored Mater. And I marked him first. He is already partly subdued. She laughed once more with a callous abandonment that shocked Lucilla. This way. There is a place where you can watch. May you die on Caladan. Ancient drinking toast. Duncan tried to remember where he was. He knew Tormsa was dead. Blood had spurted from Tormsa's eyes. Yes, he remembered that clearly. They had entered a dark building, and light had flared abruptly all around them. Duncan felt an ache in the back of his head. A blow. He tried to move, and his muscles refused to obey. He remembered sitting at the edge of a wide lawn. There was some kind of bowling game in progress. Eccentric balls that bounced and darted with no apparent design. The players were young men in a common costume of Gaia D Prime. They are practicing to be old men, he said. He remembered saying that. His companion, a young woman, looked at him blankly. Only old men should play these outdoor games, he said. Oh? It was an unanswerable question. She put him down with only the simplest of verbal gestures. And betrayed me the next instant to the Harkonnens. So that was a pre-Gola memory. Gola. He remembered the Bene Gesserit keep on Gamu, the library. Holo photos and tri-photos of the Atreides Duke, Leto I. Teg's resemblance was not an accident. A bit taller, but otherwise it was all there. That long, thin face with its high bridge nose. The renowned Atreides charisma. Teg. He remembered the old Bashar's last gallant stand in the Gamu night. Where am I? Tormsa had brought him here. They had been moving along an overgrown track on the outskirts of Isai. Barony. It started to snow before they were 200 meters up the track. Wet snow that clung to them. Cold, miserable snow that set their teeth chattering within a minute. They paused to bring up their hoods and close the insulated jackets. That was better. But it would be night soon. Much colder. There is a shelter of sorts up ahead, Tromsa said. We will wait there for the night. When Duncan did not speak, Tormsa said, It won't be warm, but it will be dry. Duncan saw the gray outline of the place in about 300 paces. It stood out against the dirty snow some 2 stories tall. He recognized it immediately. A Harkonnen counting outpost. Observers here had counted and sometimes killed the people who passed. It was built of native dirt turned into one giant brick by the simple expedient of preforming it in mud bricks and then superheating it with a wide bore burner, the kind the Harkonnens had used to control mobs. As they came up to it, Duncan saw the remains of a full field defensive screen with fire lance gaps aimed at the approaches. Someone had smashed the system a long time ago. Twisted holes in the field net were partly overgrown with bushes. But the fire lance gaps remained open. Oh, yes. To allow people inside a view of the approaches. Tromsø paused and listened, studying their surroundings with care. Duncan looked at the counting station. He remembered them well. What confronted him was a thing that had sprouted like a deformed growth from an original tubular seed. The surface had been baked to a glassine finish. Warts and protrusions betrayed where it had been superheated. The erosion of eons had left fine scratches in it, but the original shape remained. He looked upward and identified part of the old suspensor lift system. Someone had jerry-rigged a block and tackle to the outbar. so the opening through the full-field screen was of recent making. Tormsa disappeared into this opening. As though a switch had been thrown, Duncan's memory vision changed. He was in the No Globes library with Teg. The projector was producing a series of views through modern Isai. The idea of modern took on an odd overtone for him. Berenice had been a modern city, if you thought of modern as meaning technologically usiform, up to the norms of its time. It had relied exclusively on suspensor guide beams for transport of people and material, all of them high up, no ground-level openings. He was explaining this to Teg. The plan translated physically into a city that used every possible square meter of vertical and horizontal space for things other than movement of goods and humans. The guide beam openings required only enough headroom and elbow room for the universal transport pods. Teg spoke. The ideal shape would be tubular with a flat top for the thopters. The Harkonnens preferred squares and rectangles. That was true. Duncan remembered Berenice with a clearness that made him shiver. Suspensor tracks shot through it like wormholes, straight, curved, flipping off at oblique angles, up, down, sideways. Except for the rectangular absolute imposed by Harkonnen whim, Berenice was built to a particular population design criterion, maximum stuffing with minimum expenditure of materials. The flat top was the only human-oriented space in the damn thing, he remembered telling that to Teg and Lucilla both. Up there on top were penthouses, guard stations at all the edges, at the thopter pads, at all the entries from below, around all of the parks. People living on the top could forget about the mass of flesh squirming in close proximity just below them. No smell or noise from that jumble was allowed on top. Servants were forced to bathe and change into sanitary clothing before emerging. Teg had a question. Why did that massed humanity permit itself to live in such a crush? The answer was obvious, and he explained it. The outside was a dangerous place. The city's managers made it appear even more dangerous than it actually was. Besides, few in there knew anything about a better life outside. The only better life they knew about was on top. And the only way up there was through an absolutely abasing servility. It will happen, and there's nothing you can do about it. That was another voice echoing in Duncan's skull. He heard it clearly. Paul. How odd it was, Duncan thought. There was an arrogance in the prescient, like the arrogance of the Mentat seated in his most brittle logic. I never before thought of Paul as arrogant. Duncan stared at his own face in a mirror. He realized with part of his mind that this was a pre-Gola memory. Abruptly, it was another mirror, his own face, but different. That darkly rounded face had begun to shape into the harsher lines it could have if it matured. He looked into his own eyes. Yes, those were his eyes. He had heard someone describe his eyes once as cave-sitters. They were deeply inset under the brows and riding atop high cheeks. He had been told it was difficult to determine if his eyes were dark blue or dark green unless the light were just right. A woman said that. He could not remember the woman. He tried to reach up and touch his hair, but his hands would not obey. He remembered then that his hair had been bleached. Who did that? An old woman. His hair was no longer a cap of dark ringlets. There was the Duke Leto staring at him in the doorway to the dining room on Caladan. "We will eat now," the Duke said. It was a royal command, saved from arrogance by a faint grin that said, "Somebody had to say it." What is happening to my mind? He remembered following Tormsa to the place where Tormsa said the no-ship would meet them. It was a large building, bulking in the night, There were several smaller outbuildings below the larger structure. They appeared to be occupied. Voices and machine sounds could be heard in them. No faces showed at the narrow windows. No door opened. Duncan smelled cooking as they passed the larger of the outbuildings. This reminded him that they had only eaten dry strips of leathery stuff that Tormsa called travel food that day. They entered the dark building. Light flared. Tormsa's eyes exploded in blood. Darkness. Duncan looked at a woman's face. He had seen a face like this one before. A single tride taken from a longer holo sequence. Where was that? Where had he seen that? It was an almost oval face with just a small widening at the brow to mar its curved perfection. She spoke. My name is Mirbella. You will not remember that, but I share it now as I mark you. I have selected you. I do remember you, Mirbella. Green eyes set wide under arched brows gave her features a focal region that left chin and small mouth for later examination. The mouth was full-lipped, and he knew it could become pouting in repose. The green eyes stared into his eyes. How cold that look! The power in it. Something touched his cheek. He opened his eyes. This was no memory. This was happening to him. It was happening now. Mirbella. She had been here, and she had left him. Now she was back. He remembered awakening naked on a soft surface, a sleeping pad. His hands recognized it. Mirbella unclothed, just above him, green eyes staring at him with a terrible intensity. She touched him simultaneously in many places. A soft humming issued from between her lips. He felt the swift erection, painful in its rigidity. No power of resistance remained in him. Her hands moved over his body. Her tongue. The humming. All around him, her mouth touching him. The nipples of her breasts grazed his cheeks, his chest. When he saw her eyes, he saw conscious design. Mirbella had returned, and she was doing it once more. Over her right shoulder, he glimpsed a wide plaz window. Lucilla and Versmalli behind that barrier. A dream? Versmalli pressed his palms against the plaz. Lucilla stood with folded arms, a look of mingled rage and curiosity on her face. Mirbella murmured in his right ear, My hands are fire. Her body hid the faces behind the plaz. He felt the fire wherever she touched him. Abruptly, the flame engulfed his mind. Hidden places within him came alive. He saw red capsules like a string of gleaming sausages passing before his eyes. He felt feverish. He was an engorged capsule, excitement flaring throughout his awareness. Those capsules, he knew them. They were himself. They were... All of the Duncan Idahos, original and the serial Golas, flowed into his mind. They were like bursting seed pods, denying all other existence except themselves. He saw himself crushed beneath a great worm with a human face. Damn you, Leto. Crushed and crushed and crushed, time and again. Damn you, damn you, damn you. He died under a Sardaukar sword. Pain exploded into a bright glare swallowed by darkness. He died in a thopter crash. He died under the knife of a fish-speaker assassin. He died and died and died. And he lived. The memories flooded him until he wondered how he could hold them all. The sweetness of a newborn daughter held in his arms. The musky odors of a passionate mate. The cascade of flavors from a fine Danian wine. The panting exertions of the practice floor. The axolotl tanks. He remembered emerging time after time. Bright lights and padded mechanical hands. The hands rotated him, and in the unfocused blurs of the newborn, he saw a great mound of female flesh, monstrous in her almost immobile grossness. A maze of dark tubes linked her body to giant metal containers. Axolotl tank? He gasped in the grip of the serial memories that cascaded into him. All of those lives. All of those lives. Now he remembered what the Tlilazu had planted in him. The submerged awareness that awaited only this moment of seduction by a Bene Gesserit imprinter. But this was Mirbella, and she was not Bene Gesserit. She was here, though, ready at hand, and the Tlilazu pattern took over his reactions. Duncan hummed softly and touched her, moving with an agility that shocked Mirbella. He should not be this responsive. Not this way. His right hand fluttered against the lips of her vagina, while his left hand caressed the base of her spine. At the same time, his mouth moved gently over her nose, down to her lips, down to the crease of her left armpit. And all the time he hummed softly in a rhythm that pulsed through her body, lulling, weakening. She tried to push away from him as he increased the pace of her responses. How did he know to touch me there at just that instant? And there? And there? Oh, holy rock of Dur. How does he know this? Duncan marked the swelling of her breasts and saw the congestion in her nose. He saw the way her nipples stood out stiffly, the areolae darkening around them. She moaned and spread her legs wide. Great Mater, help me. But the only great mater she could think of was locked securely away from this room, restrained by a bolted door and a plas barrier. Desperate energy flowed into Mirbella. She responded in the only way she knew, touching, caressing, using all of the techniques she had learned so carefully in the long years of her apprenticeship. To each thing she did, Duncan produced a wildly stimulating countermove. Mirbella found that she no longer could control all of her own responses. She was reacting automatically from some well of knowledge deeper than her training. She felt her vaginal muscles tighten. She felt the swift release of lubricant fluid. When Duncan entered her, she heard herself groan. Her arms, her hands, her legs, her entire body moved with both of the response systems. Well-trained automation, and the deeper, deeper plunging awareness of other demands. How did he do this to me? Waves of ecstatic contractions began in the smooth muscles of her pelvis. She sensed his simultaneous response and felt the hard slap of his ejaculation. This heightened her own response. Ecstatic pulsations drove outward from the contractions in her vagina. Outward. Outward. The ecstasy engulfed her entire sensorium. She saw a spreading blaze of whiteness against her eyelids. Every muscle quivered with an ecstasy she had not imagined possible for herself. Again the wave spread outward. Again and again. She lost count of the repetitions. When Duncan moaned, she moaned, and the wave swept outward once more. And again. There was no sensation of time or surroundings, only this immersion in a continuing ecstasy. She wanted it to go on forever, and she wanted it to stop. This should not be happening to a female. An honored mater must not experience this. These were the sensations by which men were governed. Duncan emerged from the response pattern that had been implanted in him. There was something else he was supposed to do. He could not remember what it was. Lucilla. He imagined her dead in front of him. But this woman was not Lucilla. This was Mirbella. There was very little strength in him. He lifted himself off Mirbella and managed to sink back onto his knees. Her hands were fluttering in an agitation he could not understand. Mirbella tried to push Duncan away from her, and he was not there. Her eyes snapped open. Duncan knelt above her. She had no idea how much time had passed. She tried to find the energy to sit up and failed. Slowly, reason returned. She stared into Duncan's eyes, knowing now who this man must be. Man. He was only a youth. But he had done things. Things. All of the honored maters had been warned. There was a Gola armed with forbidden knowledge by the Tlilazu. That Gola must be killed. A small burst of energy surged into her muscles. She raised herself on her elbows. Gasping for breath, she tried to roll away from him and fell back to the soft surface. By the holy rock of Dur, this male could not be permitted to live. He was a Gola, and he could do things permitted only to honored maters. She wanted to strike out at him, and at the same time, she wanted to pull him back onto her body. The ecstasy. She knew that whatever he asked of her at this moment, she would do. She would do it for him. No, I must kill him. Once more, she raised herself onto her elbows and from there managed to sit up. Her weakened gaze crossed the window where she had confined the great honored mater and the guide. They still stood there looking at her. The man's face was flushed. The face of the great honored mater was as unmoving as the rock of Dur itself. How can she just stand there after what she has seen here? The great honored mater must kill this Gola. Mirbella beckoned to the woman behind the plaz and rolled toward the unlocked door beside the sleeping pad. She barely managed to unbolt and open the door before falling back. Her eyes looked up at the kneeling youth. Sweat glistened on his body. His lovely body. No. Desperation drove her off onto the floor. She was on her knees there and then, mostly by willpower. She stood. Energy was returning, but her legs trembled as she staggered around the foot of the sleeping pad. I will do it myself without thinking. I must do it. Her body swayed from side to side. She tried to steady herself and aimed a blow at his neck. She knew this blow from long hours of practice. It would crush the larynx. The victim would die of asphyxiation. Duncan dodged the blow easily, but he was slow. Slow. Mirbella almost fell beside him, but the hands of the great honored mater saved her. Kill him, Mirbella gasped. He's the one we were warned about. He's the one. Mirbella felt hands on her neck, the fingers pressing fiercely at the nerve bundles beneath the ears. The last thing Mirbella heard before unconsciousness was the great honored mater saying, We will kill no one. This Gola goes to Rakis. The worst potential competition for any organism can come from its own kind. The species consumes necessities. Growth is limited by that necessity, which is present in the least amount. The least favorable condition controls the rate of growth. Law of the minimum. From Lessons of Arrakis. The building stood back from a wide avenue behind a screen of trees and carefully tended flowering hedges. The hedges had been staggered in a maze pattern, with man-high white posts to define the planted areas. No vehicle entering or leaving could do so at any speed above a slow crawl. Tegg's military awareness took all of this in as the armored ground car carried him up to the door. Field Marshal Muzaffar, the only other occupant in the rear of the car, recognized Tegg's assessment and said, We're protected from above by a beam enfilading system. A soldier in camouflage uniform with a long laser gun on a sling over one shoulder opened the door and snapped to attention as Muzaffar emerged. Tegg followed. He recognized this place. It was one of the safe addresses Bene Gesserit security had provided for him. Obviously, the sisterhood's information was out of date. Recently out of date, though, because Muzaffar gave no indication that Teg might know this place. As they crossed to the door, Teg noted that another protective system he had seen on his first tour of Isai remained intact. It was a barely noticeable difference in the posts along the trees and hedges barriers. Those posts were scanlizers operated from a room somewhere in the building. Their diamond-shaped connectors read the area between them and the building. At the gentle push of a button in the watcher's room, the scanlizers would make small chunks of meat out of any living flesh crossing their fields. At the door, Muzaffar paused and looked at Teg.
The honored mater you are about to meet is the most powerful of all who have come here. She does not tolerate anything but complete obedience.
I take it that you are warning me.
I thought you would understand. Call her honored mater, nothing else. In we go. I've taken the liberty of having a new uniform made for you.
The room where Muzaffar ushered him was one Teg had not seen on his previous visit. Small and crammed with ticking black paneled boxes, it left little room for the two of them. A single yellow glow globe at the ceiling illuminated the place. Muzaffar crowded himself into a corner while Teg got out of the grimed and wrinkled single suit he had worn since the no-globe.
"Sorry, I can't offer you a bath as well," Muzaffar said. "But we must not delay. She gets impatient."
A different personality came over Teg with the uniform. It was a familiar black garment, even to the starbursts at the collar. So he was to appear before this honored mater as the sisterhood's bashar. Interesting. He was once more completely the bashar. Not that this powerful sense of identity had ever left him. The uniform completed it and announced it, though. In this garment, there was no need to emphasize in any other way precisely who he was.
"That's better," Muzaffar said as he led Teg out into the entry hallway and through a door Teg remembered.
Yes, this was where he had met the safe contacts. He had recognized the room's function then, and nothing appeared to have changed it. Rows of microscopic comeis lined the intersection of ceiling and walls, disguised as silver guide strips for the hovering glow globes. The one who is watched does not see, Teg thought, and the watchers have a billion eyes. His doubled vision told him there was danger here, but nothing immediately violent. This room, about 5 meters long and 4 wide, was a place for doing very high-level business. The merchandise would never be an actual exposure of money. People here would see only portable equivalents of whatever passed for currency. Melange, perhaps, or milky Sioux stones about the size of an eyeball, perfectly round, at once glossy and soft in appearance, but radiant with rainbow changes directed by whatever light fell on them, or whatever flesh they touched. This was a place where a denikin of melange or a small fold pouch of Sioux stones would be accepted as a natural occurrence. The price of a planet could be exchanged here with only a nod, an eye blink, or a low-voiced murmur. No wallets of currency would ever be produced here. The closest thing might be a thin case of translux, out of whose poison-guarded interior would come thinner sheets of Redulian crystal, with very large numbers inscribed on them by unforgeable data print. "This is a bank," Teg said.
"What?"
Muzaffar had been staring at the closed door in the opposite wall.
"Oh, yes. She'll be along presently."
"She is watching us now, of course." Muzaffar did not answer, but he looked gloomy. Teg glanced around him. Had anything been changed since his previous visit? He saw no significant alterations. He wondered if shrines such as this one had undergone much change at all over the eons. There was a dew carpet on the floor, as soft as brant down, and as white as the underbelly of a fur whale. It shimmered with a false sense of wetness that only the eye detected. A bare foot, not that this place had ever seen a bare foot, would feel caressing dryness. There was a narrow table about 2 meters long, almost in the center of the room. The top was at least 20 millimeters thick. Teg guessed it was Danian jacaranda. The deep brown surface had been polished to a sheen that drank the vision and revealed far underneath veins like river currents. There were only 4 admiral's chairs around the table, chairs crafted by a master artisan from the same wood as the table, cushioned on seat and back with lyre leather of the same tone of the polished wood. Only 4 chairs. More would have been an overstatement. He had not tried one of the chairs before, and he did not seat himself now, but he knew what his flesh would find there. Comfort almost up to the level of a despised chair dog. Not quite at that degree of softness and conformity to bodily shape, of course. Too much comfort could lure the sitter into relaxation. This room and its furnishing said, "Be comfortable here, but remain alert." You not only had to have your wits about you in this place, but also a great power of violence behind you, take thought. He had summed it up that way before, and his opinion had not changed. There were no windows, but the ones he had seen from the outside had danced with lines of light, energy barriers to repel intruders and prevent escape. Such barriers brought their own dangers, Teg knew, but the implications were important. Just keeping the energy flow in them would feed a large city for the lifetime of its longest-lived inhabitant. There was nothing casual about this display of wealth. The door that Muzaffar watched opened with a gentle click. Danger. A woman in a shimmering golden robe swept into the room. Lines of red-orange danced in the fabric. She is old. Teg had not expected her to be this ancient. Her face was a wrinkled mask. The eyes were deeply set green ice. Her nose was an elongated beak whose shadow touched thin lips and repeated the sharp angle of the chin. A black skullcap almost covered her gray hair. Muzaffar bowed.
"Leave us," she said.
He left without a word, going out through the door by which he had entered. When the door closed behind him, Teg said, "Honored Mater."
"So, you recognize this as a bank?"
Her voice carried only a slight trembling. "Of course."
"There are always means of transferring large sums or selling power," she said. "I do not speak of the power that runs factories, but of the power that runs people.
And that usually passes under the strange names of government, or society, or civilization," Teg said.
"I suspected you would be very intelligent," she said.
She pulled out a chair and sat, but did not indicate that Teg should seat himself.
"I think of myself as a banker. That saves a lot of muddy and distressful circumlocutions."
Teg did not respond. There seemed no need. He continued to study her.
"Why are you looking at me like that?" she demanded.
"I did not expect you to be this old," he said.
"We have many surprises for you, Bashar. Later, a younger honored mater may murmur her name to mark you. Praise Dur if that happens."
He nodded, not understanding much of what she said.
"This is also a very old building," she said. "I watched you when you came in. Does that surprise you, too?"
"No."
"This building has remained essentially unchanged for several thousand years.
It is built of materials that will last much longer still. He glanced at the table. Oh, not the wood, but underneath it's polystyrene, polaz, and formabat. The three POs are never sneered at where necessity calls for them. Teg remained silent. Necessity, she said. Do you object to any of the necessary things that have been done to you? My objections don't matter, he said. What was she getting at? Studying him, of course, as he studied her. Do you think others have ever objected to what you did to them? Undoubtedly. You're a natural commander, Bashar. I think you'll be very valuable to us. I've always thought I was most valuable to myself. Bashar, look at my eyes. He obeyed, seeing little flecks of orange drifting in across the whites. The sense of peril was acute. If you ever see my eyes fully orange, beware, she said. You will have offended me beyond my ability to tolerate. He nodded. I like it that you can command, but you cannot command me. You command the muck, and that is the only function we have for such as you.